I ended part one of this mini-series on the history of Christians in the Middle East by talking about the twin disasters befalling that community. The campaigns of Tamerlane, which were tantamount to genocide, mainly targeted against the Nestorian Church, which had once been allies with his Mongol predecessors, and the complete repudiation of the legacy of the Crusades by the Mamluks, who, throughout the 13th and 14th centuries, were essentially able to eliminate the vestiges of Catholic rule and incarcerate the remainder of the Christians in Syria and Egypt. The continuation of this conquest against the last crusading outposts would endure throughout the history of the early Ottoman Empire, through the conquest of Cyprus, the island of Rhodes in the early 16th century, and even the island of Crete in the 1660s. The legacy of the Crusades in terms of demographic continued through the Latin Church of the East and the descendants thereafter of the Genoese republics, the Venetian republics, and of course that of the Crusaders themselves. Mainly these people were of Italian and French ethnicities, and eventually they would intermarry with the Muslim populations there, and only to this day retain a very small percentage, to the point they are often derided as Levantine, and therefore not entirely European. If we can refer to the Christian history of the 14th and 15th century as catastrophic, and that is no overstatement, then this segment is going to represent the interlude between catastrophes, the period during which the Ottomans were ascendant in the Middle East, and during that time held effective sway, i.e., were in power, during their rise and before their dissolution. The Ottomans had started off by directing their conquests mainly against Europe. They crossed over the Dardanelles Straits in the 14th century and began conquering areas like modern-day Greece, Bulgaria, and Serbia, expanding into Romania and even as far as Hungary and Vienna, albeit never taking that city. It was only during the reign of Selim the Grim that, in a very short space of time in the early 16th century, the Ottomans expanded out of their heartlands in Asia Minor and conquered Iraq, Armenia, or at least the majority of it, the Levant, and indeed Egypt. Not since the Abbasid Caliphate in the 10th century had one Muslim power held sway over the entirety of the Middle East, in the Abbasid case, however, with the exception of Asia Minor, and in the Ottoman case, with the exception of Iran, which was held by their main adversaries in the Middle East, the Muslim Shia Safavid dynasty. The Ottomans, rather than innovating in terms of the management of Christians, merely inherited the structures of the Islamic empires that came before them. The provision for dhimmis was structured around the idea of the millet, the nation, but these millets were not nations built on ethnicities, but rather demarcations made on the basis of religion. And you can see that these millets were rather a system of allegiance groups, groups to be shepherded under a particular ethnarch, invariably a religious head, who swore fealty, obedience to the Ottoman sultan or padishah, master king. So in this sense, you can say that the relationship was fundamentally that of feudal relations, that of reciprocal obligations, as stipulated in the Pact of Umma, which provided the legal definition of discrimination of Christians, their relationship with Muslims in return for protection. Having established this relationship with the Orthodox Patriarch in Constantinople, Gennadius Scholarius, this system, of course, related to the Greek Orthodox communities in the Levant and in Egypt. But the Ottomans extended the system to create an Armenian millet under the headship of the Armenian Patriarch. But ultimately, the Armenian millet is a bit of a misnomer because it would come to represent all the Oriental Orthodox Christians within the Ottoman Empire, the Copts and the Syriac divisions. Why was it called the Armenian Millet then? Well, if anything, the demarcation of an Armenian Millet is to indicate the dominance and the influence of the Armenian community throughout the Ottoman Empire. This may come as a surprise given the history of the Armenian genocide and the Ottoman persecutions at the end of the 19th century. But the Armenians occupied a quarter in Constantinople, and as a mercantile class, were an elite with links throughout all of Europe, as with the Phanariotes or the Greek elites, and thereby were essential for the Ottomans in maintaining commercial and political dominance. Such was the case that the Iranians attempted to imitate the system when Armenians were brought back to Esfahan to establish their own Armenian quarter in the Safavid court. So, Oriental Orthodoxy, therefore, was essentially subjugated to a hierarchy of Armenians. Then, in addition to that, you have the creation of a Catholic millet. As I explained in the previous episode, the position of Catholics in the Middle East was incredibly varied in terms of the Latin patriarchates, which were the legacies of the Crusades, the Maronites, who of course were focused on Lebanon, and the Syriac churches, who were allied with, or rather in communion with, the Pope in Rome. And that in addition to all of the foreign missionaries and Catholics of all ethnicities and all subsets and liturgical groups that dotted throughout the entire Ottoman Empire. And of course this would be expanded greatly when the Ottomans took over places like Rhodes, the Catholic Greek areas, and even places like Hungary. But what signified, you can say, the distinctiveness of the Catholic millet vis-a-vis the Armenian millet and the Orthodox millet, whose leadership essentially bore residence within the Ottoman Empire. Of course, the Pope, from which all these Catholic communities owed allegiance, was independent of the Ottomans. But more than that, the structure of the Catholic millet was based on the Franco-Ottoman alliance, an alliance formed in the 1530s against the mutual enemy of these two great powers, which of course was that of the Habsburg Empire of Spain and Austria. As per this alliance, and almost to offset the fact that France was seen to have made a pact with the devil in terms of the ongoing fight between Christendom and Islam, to sate fears among Christians back in Europe, and also to elevate the prestige of France within the Ottoman Empire, the French ambassador effectively acted as the go-between between Christians in the East and the West. He became their representative. He became their protector. So in the sense that the Pope became their spiritual protector, or rather remained their spiritual protector, the French ambassador remained their secular protector. And indeed, the longevity of the Ottoman-French alliance depended on Ottoman goodwill towards the Catholic populations within the empire. But this is not to say that the Christians were united under the Ottoman Empire. No, in fact, the Ottomans consolidated the divisions between Oriental Orthodoxy, Orthodoxy, Greek Orthodoxy, and that of the Catholic denominations. And what makes this more confusing is that the division continues and various groups switch sides during the next several centuries. So, for example, in the 1660s, one Patriarch Ignatius of the Syriac Orthodox Church precipitates a schism which saw many Syriac Christians enter into communion with Rome. Then we see the Melikite Greek Catholic Church in 1724, the lingering elements of that schism which pervaded the Church of Antioch in Syria after the Council of Chalcedon some 1300 years before. Together with the Catholic Maronites and the Latin Patriarchate, established during the Crusades, a position which was now ceremonial, there were, by the end of the 18th century, four Catholic Patriarchs of Antioch, an Oriental Orthodox Patriarch, and a Greek Orthodox Patriarch, testament to 1,500 years of schism and counter-schism. What fundamentally alters this picture with the endurance of the Ottoman Empire, an endurance which is abnormal in the long history of Islam, especially when you look to its great equivalent in the Middle East, which was that of the Sunni Abbasid Caliphate, because the Ottomans would exert control over this region almost without incident for 300 years, and often as a result of maintaining good relations with their Christian populations. But of course, the Ottoman Empire participated and continued the system of slavery. In terms of the innovations that the Ottoman Empire made to the Pact of Umar was that of the creation of the Devashirme, the slave levy, and the creation of the Janissary Corps, which by the 17th and 18th centuries had the ability to control and depose the essentially incarcerated sultans who were kept within the confines of the harem until they were allowed to be released at a certain age. All of this changed when you can say that the legacy of the Crusades rebounded in the Ottoman Empire after 300 years. And the most visible example of this is Napoleon's invasion of Egypt. Of course, when Napoleon came to Egypt, there was barely any crusading sentiment of the atheist in service of the French Republic in coming towards Egypt. Rather, it was directed against the maritime dominance of the British. But when Napoleon arrived, he tried to bring the Coptic Christians over to the support of the French. And he did so extolling the values of the French Revolution, that of religious liberation, that of elevating them from dhimmi, tolerated persons of the book, into becoming citizens, in which there would be fundamentally no demarcation between Muslims and Christian Copts. And Christians would have all the privileges of Muslims, most specifically that to bear arms, which was expressly prohibited under the Pact of Umar. But of course, this didn't go so far as Napoleon attempting to bring back a Christian Egypt as had existed in the 7th century. And indeed, Napoleon's innovations in this regard were undone almost immediately after, when he abandoned his Egyptian conquest and left command to one General Menou, who appealed to the loyalty of Muslims to France by announcing that he himself had converted to Islam, and then he subsequently began to purge all Coptic Christians serving in the then Egyptian government. Nevertheless, subsequent French relations with Middle Eastern Christians were to be far more amicable. The Muslim governments of Muhammad Ali Pasha, the Albanian who would come to dominate Egypt, and indeed he would provide the dynasty which would rule Egypt until 1950. French relations through the Ali Pasha dynasty ensured their enduring influence in Egypt and indeed in Syria when the Pashas expanded out in the 1830s and even threatened Constantinople itself. French support was critical in terms of gaining a foothold in Egypt and Syria. This continued until we see the creation of the Suez Canal, but ultimately the English, especially in Egypt, were able to supplant that of the French influence. And the precipitation for this again was the persecution of Christians, as per a Turkish uprising in 1880 within the Khedivate of Egypt, which evolved into an anti-Western and anti-Christian uprising. The murder of Christian missionaries and attacks and massacres in Alexandria gave Britain a moral impetus, which of course was already substantiated by a major strategic design, to take control of Egypt and thereby guarantee the jugular vein of the British Empire, connecting its Mediterranean Empire with that of India and its possessions in the rest of Africa and the Far East. Thereafter, Ottoman control, Muslim control in Egypt remained only nominal, and Christians were essentially guaranteed an element of security under the new British-controlled Khedivate of Egypt. As for what was going on in the rest of the Ottoman Empire with regards to Catholics, during the Russian expansion at the expense of the Ottomans, after the secession of the Crimean Khanate to the protectorship of the Russians, per treaty stipulations, have been afforded the right of protectors of the Orthodox populations within the East. Earlier on in this presentation, I refer to the fact that the French ambassador in the 16th century had been afforded a similar stipulation as per the agreement of the Franco-Ottoman alliance. Napoleon III would use this as a way of countering Russian influence and precipitating the Crimean War. In other words, he was asserting his role as the supreme protector of Catholics within the Ottoman Empire. Given the fact that Napoleon III was instrumental in pushing the Russians out of the Ottoman Empire as per the Crimean War, and given the fact that the Ottomans were no longer in any position to resist the encroachments of Europeans, Napoleon III could affect this policy of protection like none other in terms of all of his Catholic predecessors. And indeed, this marks, you can say, a radical shift from the rampant atheism and indeed aspects of post-Christian deism encapsulated in figures like Robespierre, who wanted to destroy the Catholic Church in France, as opposed to Napoleon III coming back and treating the defence of Catholics in the world as his primary motivator for French foreign policy. That, and of course, it facilitated the growth of the French Empire. And the most obvious example of this was in response to the 1860 massacre of Christians in Damascus, a civil war that had broke out between the Maronite Christians and a group known as the Druze, who were their own ethno-religious group operating out of Lebanon and Syria, often in tandem with the Muslims, resulting in the deaths of some 10,000 Christians. The effect of this in terms of European sentiment and also that of power politics and the damage to prestige of Napoleon III as the protector of Catholics demanded an intervention by France. And of a European coalition put together, the French were the majority of that coalition and were directing it in allegiance with the Ottomans, who essentially wanted to restore control to that region. And the expedition was placed under the control of one Jimmu d'Otpol, who was also in the service of Ali Pasha in terms of expanding French influence by proxy into Syria some couple of decades before. You can say in a way that this represented a return of the Crusades, albeit with the European powers operating in tandem with the Ottomans, or rather forcing the Ottomans to do what they want. And this is encapsulated in the literature at that time. Within Britain, we have Walter Scott's Talisman, as per his Tales of the Crusaders. With Disraeli, we have his Orientalism, we have Tancred. With the French invasion of Egypt under Napoleon, we see the advent of scholarly Egyptology, Orientalism, and not only historical investigations into the medieval period, but you can say a Crusader kitsch embodied in the Second French Empire, but also represent an aspect of explicit French foreign policy, that of the defence of Catholics. After Napoleon XIII's intervention, the Christians within Lebanon were established with their own autonomy as part of the Mount Lebanon Mustarafate, which was first operated under a Ottoman, albeit a Christian Armenian, governor. By the second half of the 19th century, the city of Beirut, which is now the capital of Lebanon, was developing closer commercial and political ties with Europe, particularly that of France, which should come as no surprise. European interests lay in Lebanese silk and other export products, and this transformed the city into a major port and commercial centre. This increase in trade allowed certain elements, such as the Sursok family, a dynasty of Greek Orthodox Christians, to establish trade and manufacturing empires that further strengthened Beirut's economic position. Meanwhile, Ottoman power in the region, vis-à-vis its European handlers, continued to decline. Due to the civil war in Syria and Lebanon, Beirut became a destination for Maronite Christian refugees, wherein Beirut emerged as a predominantly Christian centre. In terms of demographics, by 1911, of the 120,000 size population of Beirut, 80,000 of those were Christians. The fruits of the European intervention were the security provided to the region's Christians and foreign investment. The French constructed a modern harbour and railway lines to Aleppo and Damascus, from which Beirut was the principal entrepot for maritime trade from the Levant to Marseille. The preeminence of Beirut resulted in a major restructuring of the Ottoman administration of the Levant, where Beirut was recognized as the preeminent economic and political center, as the capital of the Beirut Vilayet, or the administrative province. This is also indicative of major reforms taking place within the Ottoman Empire. The formal pacts or alliances with various religious heads, such as the leader of the Armenian Oriental Orthodox community, the Greek Orthodox community, and the Catholic community, had essentially been undone. This had to be replaced by a formal system of religious management, i.e. a codification, creating a constitution for the millet system, which was a pivotal aspect of Tanzimat, or the process of reform of the Ottoman Empire during the 19th century. This at once had the effect of recognizing the plurality of Christian communities in the Ottoman Empire, yet it also signified the end of Greek and Armenian dominance within those particular religious sects. While this represented a careful balancing act within the context of Ottomanism, which was in many ways a postmodern ideology which understood that the growth of the Ottoman Empire had resulted in this alliance between various groups, the fact that the Ottomans themselves didn't consider themselves merely Turkish, they considered themselves to be universal rulers and the heads of Islam as their caliphs. In that sense, you could bring many different ethnicities and religious groups under the control of the Ottoman Sultanate. Albeit combined to this Ottomanism, you also have the introduction of the French revolutionary elements of popular government, Rousseau and the general will. So Ottomanism in many senses represented a harkening back to the legacy of Ottoman multiculturalism, for lack of a better word, yet it also represented elements which were antithetical to Ottoman autocracy, such as that of European parliamentarianism and democracy, hence the conundrum that is Tanzimat. Indeed, trying to link this idea of ethnic loyalty to the central government in Istanbul, combined with the growing consciousness of ethnicities, more than simple religious differentiations or group, which have been obvious for centuries, compounds various already existing tensions. The Ottoman dynasty, realizing the failure of Tanzimat, at first attempted to assert the preeminence of Islam under Sultan Abdul Hamid. And then the sultans would become captive to the forces of Turkish nationalism, with dire consequences for the Christians in the Middle East. The fundamental aspect culminating this period of the interlude between catastrophes and leading us into part three is the idea of an ethnic betrayal, a wholesale revolt of a people and of a community against a multicultural Ottoman Empire. If you recall back to my videos on the Greek Civil War, my belief is that the Greeks during the Ottoman Empire were the lingering elements of the Romaioi, Romans, Greek Romans, and that the Phanariotes represented a Greek Orthodox aristocracy upon which the Ottomans depended not only for administration, especially that of the administration of the Wallachian principalities as the hospodars, but also for diplomacy and for trade, especially in the 18th century as the Ottoman Empire ceased to be an empire of expansion and instead became territorially stagnant and indeed began to decline. When the Greek Civil War comes around, the Ottomans begin to eliminate the leadership of the Miletorum, the nation of Rome, the Greek Orthodox community, as everyone was in some sense responsible for this betrayal by the Greek populations in the Peloponnese and when Ypsilantis crossed the Pruth. So this idea of ethnic tensions and religious tensions, the thin line between religious loyalty to the Ottomans and this idea of independence beginning with the Greek Revolution, is the foundation of all the horrors that are going to be brought on the Christian populations within the Ottoman Empire. And it is already apparent that before we get to the 20th century, and before we come to the specific examples of the Maronites and the Assyrians, which are going to be that focus, This had already happened to the Armenians. The Armenians who, as with the Phanariotes, represented a pivotal position within the structure, the commercial, political, religious structure of the Ottoman Empire, began to be associated as a foreign subversive force, particularly emanating from the Russians, and would be the target of extreme persecutions, resulting in the deaths of thousands towards the end of the 19th century. But in terms of this period, this prelude before another catastrophe, and the interlude between the Tamerlane persecutions and the Mamluk persecutions, and the Kafnor, the starvation, and the Safo, the Assyrian genocide, I'm going to leave it here.